Welcome to The Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber, the cricket podcast where we answer your questions. If you're in the YouTubes, you can answer, you can ask, but I suppose you can answer, questions via Super Chat. And if you want to support us and you're like, I have no idea what time you're going to record the show, which is completely valid because I have no idea when I'm going to record the show, Patreon is the best way. So patreon.com/goodareaspodcast, and you can support us there and ask your questions early, like Satchmo has. Should statistics from Packer Super Test be held in the Caribbean be taken into account when picking an 11 to beat Clive Lloyd's strongest West Indies side? For example, Lillian Thompson had a strong series there in 78-79. Put them in a quartet with Imran, Hadley, and Bishan Beatty has just been, interesting. And you have an attack who could win this. So that's right. We just did a quick picks on this, and we didn't use the super test numbers, but I did mention that Lillian Thompson specifically there. I think there's probably enough other bowlers that you could go with. Like, I'm not sure, who do you want, Tomo, or do you want Waqar Yunus? I'd probably go Waqar Yunus over Tomo just because with Waqar Yunus, you're getting something completely different than the West Indies are used to, whereas obviously they had faced Tomo quite a bit. And they're used to being bombed. But the idea of having your leg stump, the base of your leg stump being attacked. And as good as Lily was, I just thought that you had, I can't remember who the full team was we ended up with, but I thought there were enough other options out there that gave something extra that Lily did. But you could do this. I think this in general is in the book about the 50 greatest batters, The Art of Batting. You can find it on Amazon now. In that particular book, you can see that we've gone, that we've mentioned it with, I think, Greg Chappell, Barry Richards. I'm trying to think if there's someone else. There might have been another batter that we had a look at as well. Because, again, it's further information. So, yeah, I'm not against it. But yeah, it's interesting went with Bishan Beatty and not Abdul Qadir there as well. Patrick says, who is a career first-class player who never played a test that you wish more people knew about? Look, I think there's two bowlers that instantly come to mind here who I both saw play a lot in first-class cricket, Glenn Chappell in Lancashire and Matthew Innes from Victoria. Just their best balls were just test quality. They were, in Glenn Chappell's case, if Hoggard and Anderson don't exist, he plays quite a few tests for England and he's a very decent bowler for England, is my guess. If he batted slightly better, he probably would have got games. There's a lot of way worse bowlers than Glenn Chappell who've played test matches for England during his career. But sometimes that's just the way it goes. Matthew Innes, let's see if I've got Matthew Innes' record here. Matthew Innes was a left arm, reasonably quick bowler, probably fast medium for Victoria over a long period of time. Obviously it was the, Rifle and Fleming and I'm trying to think of who else, Kasperwitz and Bickle, there was a lot of good second, third, fourth, fifth choice seam bowlers in Australia. But he was just, why can't I find his record? But he was just absolutely incredible. So he plays 81 first class games and takes 281 wickets at 25.77. The issue with him, the issue with him a lot was that he was seen as a new ball bowler. And I think Australia has never been as enamored with just frontline new ball bowlers as perhaps some other countries have been. But I think if you put him into some of those sides, I think he would have been, I'm trying to remember when his peak was. He's about my age, isn't he? So probably that 98 to 2002 period might have been quite interesting for Matthew Innes if he had gone on to play. Because when Fleming wasn't always available, he would have been a very good replacement for Fleming. Different kind of bowler, but again, swinging it, good with the new ball. And he wasn't useless later on. Around that period, if you had Gillespie or you had Brett Lee available, and you obviously had Shane Warne, you could cover him a little bit, but it just didn't happen. Australia picked some seam bowlers around that period that just were nowhere near the level of Matthew Innes. It went on as well, and I don't know if it's in his, he went on to work with, I want to say the Indonesian Olympic Committee, but I could be wrong, but I think he's really got into strength and conditioning and has become like a bit of a go-to person. I think he still works at cricket. I think he worked at Aussie Rules Football as well. So, and if you watch him play, he was an incredible natural athlete. And obviously that sort of side of things, like he ran in a sort of almost like, it was different than Mark Wood, but in that kind of Mark Wood way where you're just like, whoa, this guy's really coming into the crease. So those two are the two that always come to the top of my head. Trying to think of some others. There's a lot of sort of early, around that 1920s, 1930s period of players who don't play for the national team because they're signed up to people like Julian Kahn and other versions of that kind of thing. There's obviously the Fijian player, whose name I won't attempt here, where you have some players from outside of major nations. And I think we've probably had quite a few players from outside major nations who would have been very good test players or international players as well. Yasha says, it seems like teams barely care about bilateral ODIs. Will the 2027 be the last ODI World Cup? Did the ICC re-establish the Champions Trophy in an attempt to garner a little bit more ODI interest? Well, I can tell you the last question is not true. That the Champions Trophy exists largely so the people who were making money from bonuses from the ICC got more money. So the ICC would get more power. So the ICC could play more cricket. If we're being 100% honest, that's why it exists. I think the Champions Trophy will be T20 eventually anyway. It's just not quite got there yet. I know there's been conversations about it, certainly. Do teams barely care about ODI bilaterals? Yeah. I mean, I've been writing about that for years. It's been really quite clear that teams haven't taken as much interest. To be fair, teams don't care that much about T20 bilaterals either, which is, it's funny that that one's never mentioned, but it's exactly the same. Look at how many experimental teams are put out in T20 internationals. Will 2027 be the last ODI World Cup? So we did a big thing. Was it me and KSR? Did a podcast on that. I know me and Bayram have talked about it as well. Look, during the 2023 World Cup, there was heaps of conversations behind the scenes. TV companies want the prestigious World Cup to be the T20 World Cup. And if that happens, I think that's pretty much the death knell for the ODI World Cup. But that's what they want. They want that to be the major series, and they want the T20 World Cup to take over. And it hasn't happened yet. The ODI World Cup is still garners more attention and more interest than, you know. So at this stage, I think it would be a little bit risky, but I can promise you all these conversations have been had. I think we did our video on the back of the fact that we knew there were conversations within ICC and boards and everyone else and TV companies about the fact that there's no reason to have the main tournament be the 50 over one in the future. So I don't think it will be the last one. I think it will continue because the ICC need more tournaments. But very soon there will be a switch. And once there's a switch and the ODI one is no longer the most important one, that might be the end of it. Oh, my God. Oh, I read this before. This is by Person McPersonface, who says it's basically about the red ball and why we have a red ball when he says none of them indicate what type of dye. So I don't know what type of dye and how early were the balls dyed red. So the balls were dyed red quite early on. And he says that red is the hardest color to get dye for. I think one of the reasons they did it is because one of the reasons it was dyed red is because you can actually dye a ball red. As in, once you dye it red, it keeps its color all the way through. So I think there was a big part of that. Also, the lighter colored balls didn't work particularly well on wickets. They got dirty and they ended up, you know, some of this is speculation, but also some of this is like reading old stuff and trying to remember it all for you. But essentially, I would guess that the reason why the balls were dyed red was because it was easier to see and they needed something that was easy to see that could be done uniform, would be my guess. And then the second thing, the second part of that is most of early cricket is dominated by Sussex, a little bit of Hampshire, Surrey, Kent, that area, because that's the cradle of cricket. That is where cricket, the sport, was invented, right? And my guess is that red dye is probably, at that stage, was probably more available in that era. If we're being 100% honest, I would assume that is the case. But I'm not an expert on this, but I do know that I do think there were some cricket balls that were tried in other colours. As in, you've got to remember, until 1780, there isn't even an attempt to make cricket uniform. So my guess is there would have been other colours all the way through. But specifically in that part of the world, I think it was a little bit different. As far as I'm aware, pretty much all first-class cricket, certainly all test matches up until the pink ball, were red ball. And if you wanted to know more about that person, I don't even know where you would go. But my guess is, having a look at what I found recently, is the more you know about cricket in that sort of Sussex, Kent, Surrey, Hampshire type of area, the more you realize that a lot of the stuff that has happened in our sport comes from that. The interesting thing is that baseball and stoolball, so the other two sports that sort of come all from that area, I don't know if we know the exact color of the original stoolballs, but I'm assuming they're white. And that's the other fascinating thing, is that the cricket ball has a seam down the middle, and obviously the baseballs have those, you know, seams on the side. How did cricket end up with a seam down the middle and red, and the other two balls seem to be white with these other kinds of seams? I don't know if we'll ever get a great answer to that, because in truth, I don't think anyone was writing a lot of this down. There's a lot of issues when it comes to stool ball in general, because stool ball was seen as a women's sport, and it was specifically seen as a coupling sport. So if men did play it, it was like a way for, you know, you to go with your girlfriend and play some stool ball, but actually you might be in the bushes playing some hanky-panky. So no one was really writing anything down, whereas cricket was seen as a serious sport, and baseball eventually would be seen as a serious sport. So we don't know as much about stool ball. So I don't know if there were any red balls in stool ball at that stage, which is the other interesting one. Ben says, yeah, I made it too small. Ben says, I never thought that an opener who just doesn't leave would work, but we have a decent sample size now. Where does Duckett rank for openers currently? Well, there aren't many good openers, Ben. Look, I think it's just a new generation. I think if you would have said that someone whose best shot was the reverse sweep would work, you probably, a couple of years ago, you would have had an issue. 20 or 30 years ago, even if someone's main shot was the sweep. I remember lots of conversations about players who swept too much. So I think we're just in a new generation, and the way that Ben Duckett plays. It's also, if the vast majority of, well, to be honest, this isn't true anymore. There aren't many players left who leave the ball a lot. Will Young is like on his own, I think, at the moment. But if you're still bowling to conventional openers over and over again, and then you have to go up against Ben Duckett, I think there's always an adjustment that needs to be made for any bowler. You have to bowl a slightly different length to him. I think you have to bowl slightly shorter to him. Then you've got the fact that you've got a big right-hander at the other end. So I think, you know, from that point of view, there's a few different ways to go. We did a video, Ben, not that long ago on the top openers, and I think Ben Duckett was really high. I can't remember how high, sorry. Josh says, who would join Santner and Ebadot Hussain in the one great game bowling lineup? Hawani, Massey, does Laxman get in that one as well, did he? Michael Bevan, let's go fun. Alan Border, trying to think, who was the, was it Marchant de Lange, or was it the other South African who came in for one test and dominated? Toby Rowland-Jones, was he another one that came in? It actually happens, I think, fairly often, Josh. I think if you go through the history of the game, the guys that come in for one match and just are incredible, and that never happens again. Sandip says, without Mohammad Shami, do you think India have a pace attack to take 20 wickets in a Borg-Gavaskar series? How big is Shami's absence for India? I still think they could take 20 wickets. I'm not sure they could take 20 wickets quicker than Australia could take 20 wickets. So I don't know if I'm as worried about them taking 20 wickets. The Australian batting order is a little all over the place. You know, we've seen Australia struggle at times against Pakistan at home. They lost that test against West Indies at home. They don't know who their opener is. Steve Smith, they're still trying to work out. Cameron Green's still really developing, I think it's fair to say. They've got they might have to try some alternative all-rounders in the middle because of injuries and people who can't bowl and everything else. So I'm not worried about India's ability to take 20 wickets. I am worried about India's ability to take 20 wickets quicker than Australia regularly. I think that is harder to see without Mohammad Shami. I still expect him to play in that series, by the way, but it might be the third or fourth test. Let's take a quick break here on the Wagon Wheel, and we'll be back with more very soon.
This was made with NV Plays Analytic. Their pro-level stats provide detailed insights and tips to help you enhance your cricket game.
All right, Niran says, from a talent and technique perspective, how good was Phil Hughes? I remember seeing him bat very well in South Africa in 2009 and Sri Lanka in 2011, but there was a lot of talk about how poor his technique was. Realistically, he did have in England, yeah. Look, the two players that we were told had the worst techniques of all time, and I'm including myself in this, I'm one of the tellers, was Steve Smith and Phil Hughes. At that stage in his life, Phil Hughes was a more consistent run scorer than Steve Smith. The thing about disruptive techniques, and Safraz is about to go through this himself, Ben Duckett, previous question, might be another player like that. The people with disruptive techniques or different techniques or non-textbook, they're always going to stick out, and we're always going to look at that as their negative until it's their positive. So Phil Hughes, I think I once called him the Bradman of tailenders because he had a technique that was more like a tailender than a top order player in many ways. But he had an incredible eye, and he had an ability to put together runs after runs after runs. The English people originally told me he had a bad technique and he couldn't play the full ball. Then they told me he couldn't play the short ball. And I was like, he's done all these things in Australia. You know, when you fail against in an Ashes and he struggled the way that he did, you know, that becomes a narrative, right? Like if you fail against India or England, it's the predominant, you know, the fans and the media become a part of it. I think he goes on to be a very, very good player. I don't know if he goes to Steve Smith levels. I just don't think you can make as many runs as he did and then just disappear completely. Now, is Jimmy Adams a good comparison of someone who had a very weird technique who for a couple of years no one could play and then they worked it out? But Jimmy Adams would say that many different things happened with him and it wasn't his technique as much as, you know, the mental stuff that really just drove him into the position that he ended up being in. I think Phil Hughes was susceptible to that sort of stuff as well. I think, you know, and you almost, if you're going to have a technique like that, you almost need to be a Steve Smith or Safraz type person. And was Phil Hughes one of those? We don't know, but he was incredibly talented. I think it would be anyone who doesn't think he was, you know, you just can't make the amount of runs that he made in batches without being so highly talented. Vivek says, Kundaman Hartley Santner, non-Asian, tall, left arm, reasonably accurate, finger spinners. Is this a reasonable part of the blueprint for success to, in India? Is Matt Kundaman... height. Matt Kundaman height. I don't think Matt Kundaman's tall. I don't think he's short, but I would have thought he's around... the majority of the thing says 6 foot. That's not particularly tall. Not for a left-arm finger spin. It's not Ashley Giles, is it? Monty would be 6'1", 6'2". I think he's a little bit taller than me. Who else do I know who's a left-arm finger spinner? Suleiman Ben. Those are tall. So I'm not sure that Kundaman fits this. And I think if you break down what you've said here, Vivek, Kundaman is a side spinner who sort of, you know, is suited to India in one particular way. Hartley bowled very, very quick. And then you've got Santner who actually mixes up his pace and does all sorts of things. I'm not sure I would put these three in the same category as each other. I don't think then Mitch Santner, much more like a bowler like Vittori. Hartley is probably what more like maybe Akshar Patel. And Kundaman I would probably have in that sort of Jadeja. Maybe Jadeja's a little bit shorter though, isn't he? But yeah, you know, Jadeja, Steve O'Keefe kind of bowler, side spinner. I think they're all very different bowlers. And I think that's the sort of level of, you know, if you were just to take a left-arm finger spinner who's, you know, 5'11", you need to know why you're taking them and everything else. Ian says, taking into account the events in Pakistan, India, and the Women's World Cup, has this been the most unpredictable month in cricket's history? Probably. I would find it very hard to disagree with that. Yes, Ian, I think it is. We pack so much more cricket in now. I just don't know how you would ever have a period where you'd have this many upsets in a row. Rudra says, India did not name Kuldeep in the squad for Australia. Given how poorly Ashwin and Jadeja have bowled, this feels like a mistake. Does this mean he's not part of succession plans for them? And if not, who do you see as potential replacements? My guy, I don't know. I don't know why he's not going to Australia. I think taking a wrist spinner, if you have a world quality wrist spinner, which almost no one has had since Yasir Shah, you take them to Australia. You just take them. And maybe he wasn't going to play. It wasn't that long ago that we were thinking that if India were going to play a second spinner in Australia, then Kuldeep was the most likely player. So how have we gone from that to him not being in the squad? We've only seen him play in one test. I didn't think he bowled that badly. The New Zealanders still couldn't pick him. It wasn't a good test for any spinners to bowl on, so I'm not too worried about his overall figures, but I definitely didn't think he bowled badly. He was used like before Ashwin in the fourth inning. So how do we go from that? How do we go from him being used before Ashwin in a fourth innings in India to win a test to him not playing, him not getting in a squad? Is this something to do with him and Gambia? And like Gambia's just like, I don't rate him all that highly. I don't know. But I'm looking at that going, something has gone wrong. You know, Akshar's bowling, I think, I don't want to say he's slipped, but I think people have worked out how to play him a little bit better. So we were thinking not that long ago that Jadeja and Ashwin leave, but they have Washington, Akshar and Kuldeep to take over, and it was all great. And now that Washington's the only part of that that feels good, and he was the one that was sort of on the bottom tier of that, so he's jumped up. I don't really understand this move at all. I heard that Kuldeep, well, I was told he was dropped, then I heard he was injured, now he's not in the squad. So perhaps there's just more news, and this is why the BCCI need to actually do releases on people. Like, I have no idea how this has happened at the moment. Ben says, I never thought, I don't know, you did think that. You thought that a question ago. Mob says, besides Khawaja, it feels like Australia have never had many cricketers of Asian heritage coming through the ranks, unlike South Africa, England, New Zealand, who seem to have a handful at natural level. So Australia have had, I'll try and do this all off the top of my head, Dav Watmore, Stuart Clark, Khawaja, obviously, Sandhu. They've had a lot of very talented Asian players who haven't quite made it as well, like that have been in first class level that haven't quite translated over. So I think there's probably an element of that. I'm trying to think if there's any other internet. I mean, there would be other international players that I can't think of. The leg spinner, whose name I've now forgotten, who didn't come through the Australian system, but was, obviously was born and raised in Pakistan. I think I wrote about this in my book in 2009, and I used to do lots and lots of research in it. And the thing that was always said, and I mean, I think Lisa Stelaker used to say this, that a lot of people when they send their children, when their kids came to Australia, prioritized school above everything else. And I think my experience was, so one of the most, I played with Bangladeshi kids, Indian kids, Sri Lankan kids, just all the time when I grew up. And of all those guys, they were all incredibly talented. And only one of them ever tried to go on and play cricket. And he got to first 11 in district and never, never really made it all that close. But he was a fantastic cricketer. But I remember there was another kid that I played with who was maybe one of the most natural strikers I ever came up against. Just a brilliant player. The ball just bounced off his bat. And his parents just made it very, very hard for him to play. And it is one thing in Australian cricket that is probably a little bit different than, let's compare it to English cricket. So in English cricket, if you're a good young cricketer, you go to school and you spend a lot of time playing cricket at school if you're a really good player, whether you're on a scholarship or you're just a kid in a private school. You know, Millfield has better academy, conditions than anywhere in Sri Lanka or Bangladesh, right? Like Millfield have, I don't know, 20 pitches. They have people to do individual throwdowns for every single player. They have different pitches for spin, for pace, for flat pitch, whatever else. They have bowling machines. They have all this incredible technology available to them. And so in Australia, you go to school to go to school, and then you go to your club side if you want to play district cricket and state cricket, right? So that's a separate thing. Whereas it's, if you go to Millfield, you literally book in for a session before school, at lunch, and then after school for someone to do throwdowns with you or whatever it may be, or, you know, a bowling coach to help you with whatever you need, all that sort of stuff. So I'm not saying all schools are like Millfield, but there's a lot of English schools that are like that. So if you come through that system, I think you're more likely to be able to do it. Whereas in Australia, you have to go out and go into that club. And then you have to, Australian club cricket's much different than other club cricket as well. So if you want to play district cricket, I think you have to play Saturday and Sunday. So that wouldn't be the case in the vast majority of cricket countries. And then you also have to train both days of the week. So to play district cricket or, you know, any sort of grade cricket or whatever you may be in whichever place you're in, you probably need to donate 4 days of the week outside of your schooling. So that was always used as a reason. And I think that plays a part. I think now also, and Cricket Australia have probably worked this out, that Australian cricket clubs are, even more so than English cricket clubs, are really about drinking culture. And when I grew up, I think a lot of the kids felt uncomfortable in that situation if they weren't from backgrounds where that was also happening. So in some situations, that has been the case. But if you go through it all the way through, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Most of the kids I played with were really good. But also, I played under coaches and I played in clubs with great, people from, you know, Sri Lankan and Indian backgrounds. And, I played with really good Pakistani cricketers all the way through. So there is a disconnect there. And I would assume over the last couple of years, Cricket Australia have tried to work it out. But I don't know if I can give you a great answer anymore. I can give you a great answer up until 2008. And I think the schooling played a big part and the drinking culture played a big part. I don't know from here on in why there hasn't been a more, but I think if you look in Shield cricket, there seems to be more Asian cricketers coming through now than I've seen. If you went back in the 90s, there really weren't a lot, there really just weren't a lot of players that had that kind of background, even playing first class cricket. That no longer looks the case. And if you look at the Australian under 19 team and everything else, it seems like to me there's been a big change. Josh says, as a somewhat biased commentator, for this World Test Champions cycle, did South Africa get their best possible set of home and away series, and did New Zealand get their worst possible? I'd have to go back, Josh, but at the start of World Test Championship, I usually look at that sort of stuff. And yeah, I think South Africa definitely got a good one, but New Zealand got a great one a couple of years ago as well. That's part of the cycle, is there are some years I think you can almost decide not to try all that hard in the World Test Championship. I'm not saying don't try hard in the individual tests, but not look at the World Test Championship based on what your cycle is, which is a huge problem for the tournament going ahead. But it's working at the moment, so let's see how we go. Neuron says, is it fair to say that Virat Kohli is not an all-time great? Can players who are out of touch for one third of their career really be in the GOAT? Well, an all-time great, he's certainly an Indian great. No. He had about a 4 or 5 year period where he averages what, 65, 70? People, the all time greats do that, right? Like, I think there's a bit of a revisionism about him. He averaged 50 in Test cricket last year in a funk, right? I think it was last year. Where he ends up is very fair, but he did play through the wobble ball era. And a lot of players, including Steve Smith, have struggled in that era. So if the overall global averages go down, I think you have to go through that. And you have to be aware that something actually happened in the sport. So if you compare him to Mohammed Yusuf, who is going to end up with a higher batting average, Mohammed Yusuf played on incredibly flat Pakistani wickets in an incredibly flat period of cricket where everyone averaged huge amounts of runs. And made a ton of runs in draws. I could be wrong about that one. He's going to average more than Virat Kohli. Mohammed Yusuf doesn't think he's a better bat than Virat Kohli. Right? Like, no one thinks Mohammed Yusuf is a better bat than Virat Kohli. So his career looks a lot more even. But he didn't have to go through a similar kind of thing to what Kohli had to go through. So that's why every case has to be individual, right? It's why we still talk about Victor Trumper and WG Grace and Ranji, right? It's why Clem Hill is a fascinating person in the history of cricket, because these guys, their averages are not never going to be 40, 45, 50, right? I think Ranji's the only one of those guys who averages over 40 in Test cricket. But if you go back and you have a look at the circumstances, it changes things quite a bit. then you have to have a look at the fact that what they were like at their best. I think what we are seeing now is that Virat Kohli is probably a peak player. And when he was absolutely at his peak and everything in the machinery of Virat Kohli worked, he was without doubt a great batter. But outside of that, maybe not. So where does that compare him to someone like Ponting, for instance, right? I think he would be lower on the list than Ponting, but that would be another a player that you would be looking at as a similar kind of guy.
Thanks to NV Play for their in-depth performance analysis in this project. Discover more about their incredible tools and solutions on their website.
All right, Bloody Bugger says, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe post-independence, Pakistan was better than India for much of the 20th century. They had a brief period just as they became a test nation where they were quite good. But I think India was better, more consistent for a while. And then the 80s comes along and Pakistan gets a lot better again in the 80s. I don't think that quite follows the way you think it does, Bloody. But yeah, I think Pakistan were a really good side. Basically, Pakistan is a really good side when they have Fazal Mahmood, and then they go back and probably are worse than India, I would say, when they don't. This is somewhat surprising given the origins of cricket in the subcontinent in colonial cities, which had large European populations. So that makes sense. He's talking about Bombay. This is such a long question. Hence, one would expect post-independence of Bombay 11 alone would be better than Pakistan, but somehow Pakistan was able to match and even better them in India. Fazal Mahmood is a huge part of this, I think. I think what you're probably confusing here, Bloody, is the fact that cricket was written about better in those big cities. I think what India and Pakistan have proved over the years is the talent has always been everywhere. It's just that people from the right kinds of families generally went through those sides, and people from the right kinds of cities generally went through those sides. I think that the thing that you're not remembering here is that bowlers don't generally come from big cricket centres. Bowlers are usually more physical freaks of nature, and they come from other places. And I would say that Pakistan have kind of proved that all the way through. So I would assume that that is why they were more successful. I mean, India doesn't have a Fazal Mahmood until Kapil Dev, right? They have to rely on four spinners, and there's massive overlap with those spinners, and they can't fit all four of them in the side. It doesn't always work when they travel away. So even when India get a really good bowling lineup, they can't really use it the way that they would like to be able to use it because of how cricket is. So I would say early on, Fazal Mahmood is the reason that Pakistan are better. And then there's obviously, and I don't know how far you're taking all this, Bloody, but if you go all the way to the 80s, so what's that, 25, 30 years after when all this starts, Pakistan then through tape ball cricket, through reverse swing, through flat pitches, come up with a bunch of bowlers again. And again, that elevates them over India. So if you look at those two countries through the history of their cricket so far, India is a batting nation, Pakistan is a bowling nation. Batting nation allows you to be consistent. Bowling nation allows you to win more tests and be more of a threat. So, you know, and I think a lot of that is probably conditions of those two countries as well. I'd have to go through all the numbers to check what you're saying. But I think a big part of what you're talking about is that Pakistan entered test cricket with Fazal Mahmood. If he'd stayed in India and played for India, and he was supposed to play for India, I think the whole thing would have been different. Right, then you might not be saying this question at all. Gaurav says, is this the worst Indian performance in India? Since 1990, India has only lost three series. South Africa 2000, Australia 2004, England 2012, all very good teams, agreed. And even then, India were done by multiple great players. Yeah, no, that's also fair. And even rain. I agree with all that. Yes, I would say it's the worst. Performance. I'd say it's the worst performance by a team this dominant I've ever seen. I don't think we ever saw Australia or the West Indies ever play this bad. The only one that you would compare it to would be, again, New Zealand, when West Indies travelled to New Zealand and lost. And that was, they basically gave up on that tour and they thought the umpires were against them. And, you know, probably, I think, it'd be interesting to see what those players have said about that series going back. But that would be the only other one I would compare it to. I do think, though, and we just did a footmarks with Bayram, and I don't know if it's out yet, but I think modern cricket brings around more variability because of the way that players are playing it in Test cricket. And so because of that, it's more likely to have your worst result now. Whereas I think in the 2000, let's say from 1990. So from 1990 onwards, I would have assumed that vast majority of times if India was in trouble, they would have just drawn the series. Drawn the Test matches and then drawn the series. That's just not an option anymore, right? It's so hard to draw a series. It's not a series, a Test match, I should say. Adityan says, Afghanistan won the Emerging Players Asia Cup, beating India in the semis and Sri Lanka in the final. How important is this to them? Look, I think in Asia, the underage sorts of competitions are a lot more important. I briefly had a small look at it, but I didn't have a look at it all that much. Look, anything that Afghanistan wins is, you know, important to them. I don't think it's going to change their future or anything, but I think it's important. The more they win, the better it is for them. I mean, that's going to be the case for anyone, but I don't think it's like changing the world of Afghanistan cricket. Ben says, what's your opinion on Ben, Baz and Robs? It doesn't matter what your county record says, selection. Do you think that they simply don't trust county cricket records to be a fair indicator? Look, most people really in county cricket that have gone on to play international cricket will tell you that it's not always the best predictor. And I think they're just saying that quite a bit out loud now. They are looking for players who will be successful at the international level based on the skills that will translate there. Now, the issue with that is that Rob Key's big project has always been Zach Crawley. And we're in a situation now where, I need to look this back up again, for all the good that we've seen from Zach Crawley, we've seen him, you know, the Ashes was probably, you know, a highlight of his. He's now 26, he's played 50 Test matches, and his batting average is still 32, right? County cricket was a pretty good predictor of what Zach Crawley's average will be. Now, I think in the next couple of years, you might see him go up a little bit. I don't think he's suddenly going to start averaging 40 in Test cricket, but he's now experienced and everything else. And at 27, 28, 29, we should see a leap from Zach Crawley to perhaps to get him to a point where for, I don't know, he averaged 40 to 45 for 3 years. It's also possible he's out of the game by then because his technical problems have never been fixed. And his mental problems have never been fixed. His inability to understand how an innings should progress. Those are the two, you know, if you've got a technical flaw and you've got a mental flaw in your game, that's why he averages 32. He averages 19 between 76 and 100. That's the mental flaw. Thank you to Varun for that one. That's the mental flaw I'm talking about. This is why first-class cricket does matter. He never made consistent runs in first-class cricket, and so he does not know how to make first-class cricket. So he doesn't know how to progress his innings like a normal first-class player. He knows how to bash and trust himself, and he will continue to do that until he's out. And so those 70s that we see are really great. On the day, they can be transformative. They don't give the team enough runs overall, and we still know he's going to fail a bunch of times around them. So is it worth getting 70 and averaging 32? Maybe, but probably not in the long term. Okay, so they're right and they're wrong at the same time. And this is the conversation I've had it with many people involving English cricket, which is there is a reason why first-class cricket is handy, and it's to understand if people have repeatable skills. And that's the issue here. But first-class cricket in England is not particularly handy when you're picking Asian spinners for Asian conditions. It is not always particularly handy when you're picking players for West Indies wickets or Australian wickets, right? So they're right and wrong at the same time. But they have to be able to overcome this by having a proper A setup. I've said for ages, Australia, India and England have made a huge error in not just having permanent A, like an A league that is playing 15 games a year, right? Between those three, but they could prop up some of the other countries as well and they can bring in some other countries at times. That's what they should be doing, making sure their players are playing all the different conditions all the way to check. First class gives you a good idea. You've got some advanced stuff that they'll be looking at. So they'll be looking at height, release points, strength of ball from a spinner, accuracy. You know, they can do all this stuff now. So first class cricket doesn't have to be the be all and the end all. So they can use a combination of those two things. But we're still not quite there that all those special extra skills, you know, you don't want to get to a point where I think it was in the NFL where they were absolutely obsessed with hand size for quarterbacks. And everyone suggested the hand size was the most important thing for quarterbacks. And then someone realized that people weren't even measuring the hands the same way, right? So you can't just get too obsessed with that. You know, the NBA was like all these players who had negative wingspans. You can't get people with negative wingspans. And then Desmond Bain should have been in the top five of the draft, drops to, I don't know where it was, 2025. And it's like, well, Desmond Bain is clearly an all-star fringe level player. His negative wingspan doesn't matter because he's very he has other skills. So England are going towards that stuff. There is a repeatability that I like about first-class cricket, right? I don't mind picking people on bolters, right? I don't mind looking beyond the basic stats and going beyond it. That's literally what I do. But you can see things within Michael Vaughan and Marcus Trzaskowski's records that suggest they might have been successful that wasn't there when you just look at amount of runs they made in first-class cricket. Michael Vaughan was obviously on an upturn 26, 27, 28, and it might have just taken him a little bit longer to come about. And Marcus Trzaskowski made a lot of runs in very low-scoring games where he smashed the ball and no one else could hit it off the square. If you're going to look for things like that, that's absolutely great. But if you want someone to be able to average 45 or 50 in Test cricket, they have to have probably averaged 35 to 40 to 45 at a very young age in first-class cricket. That's the best predictor that we have at the moment. Cam says, it's been heartwarming to see all members of the big three suffer significant losses. I haven't even thought about that, Cam. Not a question, just something that makes me feel good. We need this to happen, right? Cricket is at its strongest when everyone is has a chance. And I think some of the last World Cups where I've come in and I'm just like, oh, it's going to be Australia, England or India again. And then the women's one is now exactly the same, right? We just need South Africa and Pakistan and Sri Lanka and Bangladesh and whoever else it may be, West Indies, to just occasionally punch up. It's just more interesting. It's just more fun. Adityan says, did you hear about the Ramiz Raja interview of Shan Masood? I read Usman's article, so I haven't seen it. Apparently, it went really bad with asking Shan how he can manage to lose six series straight at home. Probably, I would have asked the PCB chairman the same question. Anyone know who that might have been? Can you share your thoughts about this? What Rodgers did is distasteful. How would a journalist balance between asking tough questions and being distasteful? Look, it's really tough. Bayram had that thing with the Ben Duckett where I think his question was completely valid. He probably just phrased it in a slightly awkward way. And that ends up being the story. So you can get it wrong. And I've had heaps of them, right? Where I've done that. And I know exactly what I'm trying to ask. And I'm trying to do it in a way that asks the question honestly, but I don't want to piss a player off or be, talk down about them or whatever. And sometimes you get it wrong. I think Ramiz Raja's basic way of speaking is he's very dismissive of people. And I think I don't know if he is as a human or if it is just the way he speaks, but the whole of Bangladesh used to hate Ramiz Raja. And I've written a whole piece about that before. So I think he is that kind of person. And I don't know him well enough to say whether, sorry, I should say he's that kind of speaker. I don't know him well enough to know if he's that kind of person or not. There should be great questions asked in Pakistan cricket, but if you're belittling a player, I just don't think you get the best answers. I think you get the best answers by going, it's been tough. We had Andy Balburnie on the Red Inca when Ireland were doing absolute crap. And I was like, mate, this has not been good. Talk me through it. That's a better way of doing it. Empathy, right? And sometimes when you're in a press conference, that's hard to do but in a one-on-one situation or what I understand of this one, which was a TV situation, I think you can do a little bit about that. Like, mate, it's been tough, but six series on the trot, how do you even lose that many? I think is a fair way of probably framing that question, but I didn't see the video, so I can't 100% go on that. How good would Nomina and Sajid fare if they played in India? Well, if they played on some of the Indian wickets, they'd be okay. I think Sajid's a really good bowler. They seem to have had trouble against left-arm spinners. I think they'd be okay. Pakistan's problem would be in every other way that India would be a better side than them. But we're also basing this on two tests that were specifically set up for their skill sets. So I think we can get a little bit excited, but let's not go crazy. Josh says, how anxious should Indian fans be about the Bangladesh-South Africa test? Oh, my God. Probably, well, there's no, I mean, they're 261 for one as I write this, with Stubbs and DeZorzi. Bangladesh have been poor, but Bangladesh have beat Pakistan and have been absolutely terrible ever since. I would say at the moment, South Africa is going to win that one. Ruja says, this test series, Ashwin has been below par, and while And while this is particularly bad, I felt recently it hasn't been as good in the last couple of years. Yeah, is that true? Because I mean, a lot of people have said that to me. And I'm not sure that that actually follows as much. Let me just have a look here. So in 2023, he played 7 tests and had a bowling average of 17. I don't know. Is this the end for him and Jadeja? Also, why are they struggling so much with bowling through reverse sweep? This is not the first time they have been swept and reverse swept. Ah, well, this one I can answer. Okay, I think Ashwin and Jadeja are probably close to aging out, but I would not get rid of either of them, and I would talk to them about it. And if someone can average 17 last year, I don't think you dump them because they averaged 26 this year. The reverse sweep thing I can answer. They had never in their careers faced more than 30 reverse sweeps in a calendar year in India. And this year, that must be up to about 130, 140. And in the next test, it's going to take it even higher. They have never faced it on this level. A one-off reverse sweep does not bother them. They're like, it's a risky shot. I don't even need to change the field. I still think I can get you out. What has changed is the consistent amount of reverse sweeps, which now means they can't keep any pressure on. Ashwin and Jadeja cannot keep the batters on strike the way that they used to in their peak. Neither of them are great at bowling to the reverse sweep, as in it's not their main strength. You know, there are some bowlers who don't mind bowling to it and there are others who do. I saw both of them trying to fire the ball down the leg side, but the New Zealand players are down so early that it's like, they're just like, oh, that's okay. We'll just reach a little bit further. Perhaps they haven't got the ideal pitches for it and we might still get a situation, but I just think it's changed. It's a bit like when you say something like that, it would be like Rudra. It's like saying to an Indian batter, oh, you know, you played all this first-class cricket and you faced short balls before, but now you've gone to Australia and you're really struggling with the extra bounce and the amount of short balls you're facing. It's like, yeah, because they've upped. Right? And I think that is what has happened here. All right, let's take one more very, very quick break and then we will be back with... He says he can't even find the quick break. Now we'll be back with any super chats or anything else in the room.
This was made using MV Players Insights. The same technology that supports the England and New Zealand test players is available to club cricketers as well.
All right. Samit says, South Africa currently has the longest unbeaten record at home. It's very interesting that in this period, that India and South Africa are the two teams because they're the two teams that have been playing with their wickets the most. And I wonder if that's a factor. And, you know, we've seen it in IPL leagues and first-class cricket for years. Like, that's the best way to be consistent is to make your pitches suit your team. Indy Guy says, thoughts on JJ Redick and the Lakers so far? I haven't watched the Lakers play. But the media hype around it, I've actually tried to stay away because all the stuff about Bronny actually makes me sad. It's like, I saw a quote the other day from like someone in the media going, you have to understand that Bronny could make more money as an influencer. He's taking, you know, a real risk in his career to play in the NBA. He's like, what are we even talking about? Oh my God, stop talking about Bronny. So I've stayed away from the Lakers. I've watched a little bit of the JJ stuff. There was a play that they've got where I think it's a reverse play out to the wing. Which is just absolutely incredible. And they've run it a bunch of times. He's just a smart guy. I loved him as a player. I'm not a college fan, so I don't know anything about college basketball. But as an NBA player, I always loved watching him. I loved how honest he was as a media person. And I, you know, listened to his podcast and all that sort of stuff. What I like about him is he's intelligent. I'm sure he is intelligent. He's curious. He wants to know things. I think that for me is he's that kind of person, and you know, I wish him all the best success. I hope the Lakers still burn because it's the Lakers and I don't care about them. Shara says, winning a World Cup in 2011 and absolutely getting smashed in England and Australia Test Series. I'm scared as an Indian fan that history is going to repeat itself. Shara, there's no doubt this could be really tough for India. Less worried about England at the moment, but I thought coming in that they were going to have Hardik, Shami and Kuldeep. The fact that they don't have any of those three and Shami's the only one who might turn up, I worry about them a lot in Australia. England's a fair way away, so I'm not as concerned. And also England probably isn't as good as Australia. So again, I'm not as concerned. But if you want to factor it in, Shara, as well, is like the other thing I would look at is I think India overperformed in the last two series in Australia. And I think that's awesome. Overperforming for a third time in a row, though, that's an ask, isn't it? Sanjeet says, really big fan of your editing podcast. Would be amazing if you could bring a pitch curator so we could understand pitches a bit more. Yeah, no, you're right. I should. I'm trying to think. I used to, when I was a journalist, you kind of become friends with curators all the time. But now that I'm, I don't go to the grounds as much. I'm not seeing them and chatting to them and everything else. I did spend a bit of time talking to, is it Tony Hemmings, who's now with Pakistan? I did spend a bit of time talking to him when I was with Scotland because, you know, he had to explain all the different wickets to me so I could try and help the team. But yeah, I'll have a look and see. I'm not sure if there's any curators who watch the podcast. I would love to do it. I've actually got a huge list of Red Inca podcasts that I just haven't got to recently. There's been so much cricket that it's like, if you look at almost everything that me and Bayram have done has been like a reaction to a match because that's all there has been. But there's about a bit of a dip and I've got people have been asking to come on who I haven't even been able to get on yet. Matt says, Bangladesh string their games on rabbit hole BD. I think I've got that right. YouTube, even in the region, the team they're playing, what is the model and how does it make money? I don't know about the Bangladesh thing. There's some interesting things when it comes to rights and Bangladesh because at one stage there was a Bangladesh company who was taking YouTube clips offline and I couldn't find anyone in cricket who said that this organization actually owned the copyright. There's some weird thing with it and I don't know if it's some powerful person or how it works, Matt, but you're right. It doesn't make any sense to me either. Maybe it works for them though. Soham said, oh no, it's not Soham. That's Aditya says, Tristan Stubbs just got his first test 100, like literally while we were speaking, playing 200 odd balls, noticeably improved against spin, all format beast in the next couple of years. So I think I want to say Tristan Stubbs had a really good first class record and I'd covered it before when we were talking about potential players. Am I right? Yeah. So if you go back, Tristan Stubbs and Tony DeZorzi, who I think are both making runs right now, are two of the guys that they kept picking these 29-year-old, 31-year-old players who had only had two or three good years. When they had DeZorzi, Stubbs, Brevis is another one, but there's a couple of other younger guys with incredible first-class records coming through. I'm a big fan of Tristan Stubbs. I trust players, to go back to the question from earlier, who have really good first-class numbers, right? That doesn't mean they're all going to be successful, but at least I know that they know how to play against the red ball and make big numbers, right? I'd never trust a Joss Butler or Owen Morgan, right? Or Aaron Finch, because they haven't done that. Doesn't mean that they couldn't have, but they hadn't done it. Tristan Stubbs has shown it before. Soham says, you and John Norman have great chemistry. Will you continue working together? Thank you. Will you continue working together on TalkSport for a Border Gavaskar trophy? We're not covering it because New Zealand are playing England at the same time. So some of that is overlapping. We'll continue to do podcasts together, but we won't be doing commentary. Look, me and John are just friends and we're very similar people in some ways and very different in other ways, but we're just friends and we've been hanging out together since 2011. We live around the corner from each other. Like it's just easy when me and John are on. And he's become a commentator over the last couple of years and he's really started to grow into that. And Gareth Batty is probably one of my favorite people to work with in cricket. Again, because at his best, Gareth Batty can be really, really curious. And also, if you throw something at him, a lot of ex-players, if you throw something at them, like a stat or whatever, if it doesn't fit with their knowledge, they'll just be like, no. Whereas Gareth Batty will sit there and he'll be trying to work out why that might be true or not be true. And even if he disagrees it, he'll still try and intellectually process it, which is funny because he's from Yorkshire and generally his general demeanor is to be grumpy about things. But no, look, I love working with those guys. So if those who don't know, on TalkSport 2, we've been commentating the India-New Zealand series. So it's Dan McCarty and Jeremy Coney in New Zealand and the rest of us are in England. No one's in India. This is the future of sports broadcasting, it appears. But it's been great to work with all those people. Dan's a really good commentator as well. And Jeremy, is another friend. So, you know, I'm lucky enough. Dan's the only person on the crew I don't know. And me and Dan work quite well together. So it's really cool. But yeah, I don't think we'll be commentating that. Me and John will probably do some commentary of England, West Indies coming up. But before Border Gavaskar, we've now got the Following on India podcast. So we'll definitely be doing podcasts, Soham. And yeah, I think TalkSport has really embraced cricket And what they've done now is, before they only really embraced the rights and commentating, now, you know, with me and Bumble, me and Deep, me and Harmy, you know, John and I doing podcasts and everything else, there's a real push towards overall cricket on TalkSport, and just talking about the game, which hasn't been used in the sport so far. Anyway, that is it for me on the wagon wheel. Thank you to everyone for the super chats. Sorry, I couldn't get to any normal chats today, but we had a lot of extra questions in the Patreon, and I've got to go. But I am Jared Kimber. This is the wagon wheel. Stay on this channel for all the podcasts that we do. And remember to go over to the main Good Areas channel. We've got bunches. We've just done one on all of India's losses. We did obviously a really good one on Mitch Santner and New Zealand's incredible win. And we're doing a World Test Championship video. In fact, we've got Jadeja Ashwin piece. We've got the World Test Championship. Oh, and another one to see if we are in a spin playing pandemic. But more of that and more of everything here on the Good Areas Podcast Network.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.